I'm hurting. I've got a lot of people hurting, and they can't afford to hire an attorney, and you settle with them for a penny on the dollar. If that happens, I'm going to be here unless I do something else, but I'm going to be here unless someone gets rid of me. And I can assure you, with the chairman from Louisiana and the rest of this committee, if you think today's rough, just try doing something that those lawyers suggest that you don't have to do. I'm going to give you one bit of advice from your lawyer. Don't listen to your legal beagles today.
Well, I don't. I'm sure I've said enough in the past 2 weeks, so a lot of them probably may have already resigned, but that's not part of my...
To give you an idea, the reason I'm saying that, I'm aware, and I think you've handled yourself very well. And I believe you're sincere and you're an honorable person.
Absolutely.
But you have certain groups of people that aren't on the firing line that are now, and I've heard this from the backgrounds of different meetings I've had already, now that type of, I call insidious type of legal advice is trying to get up to the head man. You have a responsibility to say, I've made this commitment, this is my reputation, I'll back up what I've said or the stockholders can have my resignation. That's what I'm asking you. You don't have to commit it today, but I'm suggesting that you do as I suggest.
We're gonna make it right with your constituents. Thank you.
I apologize to all the legal people here.
LSU Law School. We have one of our members of our subcommittee here who's joined us, Mr. Tom Crawford. I'd like to recognize him for a question.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Rolfe, thank you for joining us today and for your testimony. I understand that Exxon has publicly stated that it plans to pay all claims for damages relating from the Valdez spill. Just wondering, does that mean that Exxon is not going to rely on the $14 million cap that is in place on strict liability under what I think is called the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act? Will Exxon continue to pay damages beyond that $14 million, or will Exxon expect the TAPS liability fund to pay for any of the damages that exceed that first $14 million?
Well, you may or may not know, Congressman, we have contributed one-fifth of the TAPS funds already. So, as I recall, Senator Stevens said maybe the number was like $250 or $80 million, including interest. So we feel like we've put up a large part of that, and the purpose was to insure for these kinds of things. That's in the legislation. Now, I'm not going to forego the opportunity to get back some of that money or all that money, and in the future would continue operation. It's like buying an insurance policy. The $14 million doesn't limit our liability, and that $100 million doesn't limit our liability either. And if we get that other $86 million out of that, we have more liability than that, obviously. And we're in other co-ops around the world and in this country, which are insurance co-ops. And we're going to collect the insurance that we can and apply it against these damages to the company and to people's damages and so forth. Did I answer your question?
I think you did, yes, sir. Second question. If you could try to recreate for us the scene on the bridge or the ship on the day of the grounding. I understand the captain of the ship is not at the bridge. He's in his quarters. I understand...
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you here.
I understand the captain of the ship is not on the deck. He is in his quarters. Who is at the bridge? Who is... and I'm not asking for names, but just recreate, if you will, the scene on the bridge and the responsibilities of the players who were there.
Well, the captain was on the bridge when the vessel left port, and I'm not going to take you through all the infinite detail, with a pilot, I guess a state pilot, and he had communicated regarding the level of the tanks and the stores and so forth, and then the pilot was dropped off. And the captain was still on a bridge, the third mate was on the bridge, a helmsman, and it was a lookout on one of the wings in terms of on the bridge. And the captain called, there was some ice off of the Columbia Glacier in the outgoing, outbound channel, so he called and he wanted to move over into the southbound channel, which was the northbound, when he was going southbound, he got authority to do that. He used the radio, and the Coast Guard reported. And that was based on the fact they saw the ice on the radar, plus a prior ship a couple hours before that, two or three, had seen ice in that. He then apparently set the course, and and asked, and this is...
the captain set the course?
Yes, okay. The captain's, whatever the course was, they were going ahead and basically sell. And he asked the third mate if he understood the instructions, and he was going below. For part of that time, it was on automatic pilot. It's my understanding, however, in interviews with the mate, that after the captain left the deck and was a change of watch or something, he took it off automatic pilot. Now, it gets very unclear to me, and then unclear to the interviewers, and these have been interviews by both the Transportation Safety Board and some of our people have talked to these individuals, that why they then didn't, and according to the captain, I guess he had said that you understand the instructions, you get in this other lane and you take a right and you head south over here. And I'm not using the right nautical language here, of course. And they then kept moving in a southerly direction too far, and they realized too late, try to maneuver to miss the reef, and that's where, as I understand it. But who was on the bridge was the helmsman, the third mate, and a lookout. And they had the radar up close looking for ice. And presumably this all started for evasive maneuver reasons.
Spent a little time in the Navy as a naval flight officer, but also as a midshipman. And I recall when we would leave port, our quartermaster would be using our radar or whatever other fixing devices we would have to fix our position, not every minute, but every several minutes as we departed from a hazardous area. It's just, to a guy who's not exactly a layman on this subject, it's hard to understand with the radar up and operating, looking for the ice floes, how it would be possible to miss the landmass.
Well, we didn't hit a landmass, of course. We hit the reef was at 36 feet deep.
I understand.
A lot of tankers would go over that. This tanker happened to draw 50 plus feet, so that's the problem. And so the radar wouldn't have showed that. The sonar or whatever.
But the radar would show the position of the ship relative to that known reef.
Oh, there's no question. Not only the radar, this thing has the latest in celestial navigation equipment and so forth. There's no, I don't understand it. You might, I thought someone who knew something about ships would understand it better than I do, but I don't understand it at all, frankly, why this happened.
All right, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's time has expired. I want to take a minute to welcome to our committee a former colleague of ours who spent many years here in the Congress representing the great state of Louisiana from the northwest corner of our state. Mr. Jody Wagner is with us today. Welcome, Joe. I'm not going to let him ask questions that we never get out of here. I know, Joe. Let me instead recognize the gentleman from the Carolinas again, Mr. Coble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rawl, thank you for being here. At the outset, Mr. Rawl, I want to say I think you all at Exxon have been good corporate citizens, and I realize that the one tragedy such as the one we discussed today can pretty well dismantle and undo all the good you've done. Our people will have a tendency to forget all the good you've done. I wish you well as you go about repairing your good name and your credibility. And the demeanor that you have exhibited here today, particularly to the questioning of by Congressman Young of Alaska, I am convinced that you do intend to do the best you can in making these people as whole as possible. You indicated to the chairman in response to his question that you would submit a log, if you will, as to what occurred, when it occurred. And I hope that log will express attention to a matter that we heard this morning. We were told that Coast Guardsmen were on the scene within 3 hours after the grounding. We were subsequently told by the Lieutenant Governor of Alaska and the Mayor of Valdez, that virtually nothing occurred during the first 3 days. I'd like to have someone comment on that. If the Coast Guard, in fact, was present on the scene within 3 hours, on the one hand, and on the other hand, nothing was accomplished within 3 days, I want someone to fill in the pieces for me. Not necessarily today, unless you're able to do it today.
Well, I can. I mentioned earlier that there were a number of other things going on in that two-day period, other than what I said about the delay in getting to utilize the dispersant. But certainly, that was within that period of time. This was early Saturday morning. We had people on the ground. We mobilized equipment from literally all over the world. We had dispersant come from London. We had a plane from Florida. We had another plane from Canada. We have teams as a company, and I guess the industry does too, obviously, but we have a West Coast team and a Gulf East Coast team in terms of spills. And of course, when you talk about spills, you normally talk about a barrel or two, but they're problems and we clean them up right away. All that was mobilized. Some of those people that have been experts and recently retired, they're on those teams. Those people come back, and not very many of them, but there are, we have a few people that have invented some of these dispersants that are very good in this sort of thing. So we will give you what you want. I can do a better job in a letter, or
that'll be fine.
But I think you should know that we weren't just sitting on our hands, nor was Alyeska sitting on its hands at this period of time.
That'll be fine, Mr. Rawl.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Rawl, I was a little late getting here, and you may have already covered this. If so, I apologize for repeating it. But I want to shift gears to the captain. Now, we were told this morning, and I don't recall from whom, but that the captain had recently or had completed a rehabilitation course for people who are severely troubled or addicted by alcohol. Now, if I am, hypothetically, if I have someone in my employ who is severely addicted and who enrolls in a rehabilitation course and who successfully completes it and comes back to my employ, if he occupies a position of trust and responsibility, I would have some sort of time frame whereby he is observed so that I know he, in fact, has overcome his problem. Do you all have such a time frame? And if so, walk me through some of the details on that.
Congressman, I would be glad to do this again, but I have responded to this question a little earlier in the meeting. But I'll be glad to just tell you that we have a policy, as you heard this morning, I'm sure, that helps people get back in shape. It's a policy that probably was too general in terms of what you're talking about. The facts are, though, that there is, in terms of an alcoholic, and I don't think it's a disease that you never do get over, as I understand it, they have to be watched all the time. A better plan, and we've used, and it's part, it could be done within the same policy, is give the person their, not that job back, but give them a job back. Give them a way to get recover and continue to work, but certainly not as a captain of a ship or an airplane pilot or someone in a refinery that's in the control room or a chemical plant or things of this nature. I agree wholeheartedly. This should not have happened, and but unfortunately it did. But now we never used to be explicit on these jobs as to, you know, local management would look at it and make a decision and would supposedly do the follow-up. We can't afford to do that anymore. What we're going to have to do is we have the same policy. We'll help them recover. We'll give them a job, but they're not going to drive a ship or an airplane or whatever. I don't think we. But we've taken a hard look at all that.
Thank you, Mr. Rawl. I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. The chair now recognizes from the state of Tennessee, Mr. Clement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rawl, I know all of us want the United States of America to be energy independent. We want the United States to be energy diversified.
Thank you, gentlemen.
How would you answer the question about Exxon's corporate negligence has jeopardized continued oil flow through the Alaska pipeline, as well as the potential for exploring for much-needed oil in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge and quite likely elsewhere? What should proponents of ANWR and supporters of the domestic oil industry say now?
Well, what we have to do is some of the things, and I won't go through them again, but the best way to turn around the negatives would be to get some positives and prompt settlement of claims and so on and so forth. But I think where you have to look, Congressman, in terms of ANWR or off of Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico, wherever you go, we import upwards of 40% of our crude now, even with the pipeline running full. As you know, it's 25% roughly of the domestic crude comes out of Alaska. This country already has a pretty bad balance of payments problem. I've heard the administrator of the EPA talk about then you just get foreign ships coming into lower 48 ports and so forth. I think what we have to do is just relook at all these contingency plans, and which the chairman said that's one of the purposes of your hearings. And also, I think we've demonstrated at Prudhoe Bay that we can operate, despite what you're reading here, but the administrator has also been up there, and he feels that way about it, that we can operate in the Arctic. We can certainly operate in the bayous of Louisiana and protect the environment. And, of course, that's old production in some of those places, and we've learned a whole lot about the environment in the last 40 years or so. And I think that's what we have to do as a company. That's what we have to do as an industry. But I don't think we have to exacerbate this problem as a nation by relying totally on foreign oil or energy.
Now, Mr. Rall, what you said earlier, I know to Congressman Young when he was asking you the questions, does this reimbursement of economic losses, does that relate also to the populations of animals and fish that have been killed by this spill would be covered by this reimbursement?
You mean, hunters and trappers and so forth? Certainly, if their livelihood has been impacted, I don't know how you, it's about like replacing human lives in an airplane crash. You know, you can't replace them in kind, but certainly if someone has been damaged, that would include that. The fish kill thing, in terms of the numbers of fish, experience would indicate that wouldn't be very much, probably. In terms of what Mr. Young said, however, you lose your reputation, and it's a very difficult problem. However, in the experiences of spills at large one off France, the Mexican fishing industry and the Mexican shrimping industry, as the chairman can attest, it came back very rapidly, and shrimp are fairly sensitive animals. So we just have to see, Congressman, how that part of it works out. But it does include all those things.
Do you think the excellent shipping record in Prince William Sound lulled the industry and maybe federal agencies into complacency?
I've heard that question raised. I don't think complacency is the proper word, because everyone's been going through, as we have, continuous training for spills and so forth. Now, I have a hunch, though, that what we've run into here is it's one thing to write down, here's a contingency plan for a 200,000-barrel spill, and there happened to be one of those. Now, 240 is a bigger number, but it's in the same ballpark. But when you get into the discussion where you got three or four or five people talking about it, and somebody says, well, the plan calls for dispersing, and whoever happens to have whatever job that time is not too familiar with the plan, certainly not too familiar with dispersing, and you have someone environmentally oriented who says dispersing's so worse than the oil, and there's enough confusion, it takes 2 days to reconcile that, you've lost a real window of opportunity, might be a way to put it. Now, I think when you have tests, and they have routine tests, and the Coast Guard has called tests sort of like pop quizzes when we were all in school, they'd have a test. But when you're dealing with tests or computer simulation or some of those things, and then when you wake up some morning and you got oil all over the water in a pristine bay, and somebody says, let's get the decision made, it's your decision to make, you know, you start wondering, who should I call? And you, in terms, there needs to be a lot of, one of the few good things that can come out of that out of this disaster that we've caused here is to rethink some of those, you know, who's going to act and who, well, what kind of people do you need in Valdez? And if the people that are supposed to act, are they going to be supported by the guy in the legislature or the guy in the Congress? Because if they feel uncomfortable or they feel like they're naked out there, you get a lot of delay. And in a big spill, you can't afford that.
Thank you.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes, again, in order of seniority of the subcommittee, the gentlelady from Maryland, Ms. Bentley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is a commercial question. I've gotten a lot of phone calls in my office. We're in the Baltimore area, from my constituents complaining that the price of gasoline has risen 7 to 8 cents. And they're saying, why is Exxon doing this to us when that was on the West Coast and we're on the East Coast?
This is a commercial question.
I haven't heard about it. I've frankly been very focused on the West Coast. The price of crude oil, since there was an inflection point in it, worldwide crude oil now back in early December, changed. It was an upwards inflection point as a result of the OPEC members relying on their quotas better and announcing it. You know, you've read all these things in the paper. But the price of crude worldwide went up, and in this country, $7 a barrel from early December to before this spill. And that's why the prices of products are going up.
So this incident has nothing to do with it?
Yes.
The $14 million liability cap that was set on the companies for a spill was established back in the early 70s when I was still chairman of the Federal Maritime Commission. We had jurisdiction at that time. Don't you think it's time that we look at that again? I mean, would the industry be willing to go along with that again? And, you know, we've had a lot of inflation. We've had lots of things go up. Don't you think that cap ought to be lifted substantially?
I've heard a lot about it. I don't feel like, though, that liability cap is a liability cap. What that
Maybe to you, but how about
what that permits us to do is to get it's sort of like your car insurance, as I said. You know, you have this $50 or $100 or $400 deductible, and then after that, the insurance pays. But we have contributed. We've been paying that, whatever it is, a nickel a barrel or whatever it is, as a 20% owner, we've contributed 20% of that money up there.
Yeah, but that five cents per goes on to the pipeline, not on the maritime end of it.
No, but this liability, this $100 million goes on damage caused in a case like this also.
Oh, it does. Awesome.
Yes.
Okay.
So the $14 million, we don't feel like there's any liability cap on this.
All right. Now, this $14 million also applies to all navigable waters of the United States. I mean, you may have the $100 million fund up there for the Alaskan waters, but supposing something happened down here in Chesapeake Bay, a tanker went aground down there.
I'm not sure. I really, you get me into an area now where I'm uncomfortable, but if we spill that oil in Chesapeake Bay, we'd forget
again
about the $14 million. We'll let please God we don't spill that oil on Chesapeake Bay.
Maybe Exxon, but we have other tankers coming in, and this has to apply across the board. Exxon chose not to put double bottoms on the vessel. Why did you make that decision?
Well, there's a debate, and you're having been involved in the maritime business. There's been quite a debate worldwide, and Coast Guard's been involved, and other nations have been involved. Let me just say at the outset, though, this ship, had it had double bottoms and hit this reef at this speed, we probably would have lost it, but I don't know that. But it would have breached both bottoms. Now, the double bottoms is required by the Coast Guard. In a ship with a 166-foot beam, as this had, you'd have to bring up the double bottom 11 feet above the bottom, up the side. That won't help you a heck of a lot in a collision, for example. Also, you have the problem, if you just breach the other tank, or if you breach the outside tank, you can sometimes, without breaching the inner tank and the spill, you can sometimes make the ship unstable and possibly capsize. I mean, there are a lot of, there are pros and cons, though. If you're going to hit a nice sandy beach or something, a double bottom will help a lot. And I'm not being facetious. I'm just saying, in your part of the country, or in Chesapeake Bay, or up and down, maybe in parts of Louisiana, a double bottom might. It's a mixed bag, though. There are pros and cons to that. And this ship has a double bottom under the engine room, so that you keep power. Now, the facts are, it's not really clear on this question.
It's not neat. All right. One of the reasons that's been cited from time to time, and back when the Port and Tanker Safety Act was passed in 1978, one of the arguments was that the double bottoms were not necessary. They were costly. You could carry more cargo without them, etc. Now, the Alaskan Run is a Jones Act protected run. And if it is a matter of cost, don't you think that since there's no competition from foreign tankers there, and if all tankers were required, that then the cost should not be a factor?
Well, costs are always a factor. I mean, sooner or later, you've got to have a competitive situation where
I said if all of them were required.
Yeah, well, I understand
you're running
that,
under Jones Act protection.
If we ended up, but I just want to make the point that cost is a factor, or domestic crude can't compete on the West Coast with foreign crude and a few things like that. But double bottoms are used, by the way, principally, and we have a large number of double bottom ships all over the world, and we have some in this country, where you use them for product carriers. Generally, product carriers are smaller ships. Products are, of course, more toxic in a lot of cases than crude and that sort of thing. So product carriers frequently have double bottoms on them. But I don't think the Jones Act ships already cost twice as much as what you could build a ship foreign for. And if you go ahead and add additional cost, and when we talk about oil prices fluctuating between $20 and $12 or $10 and $20, we have a lot, crude gets shut in, or wells get shut in, you have a real problem maintaining the national crude production we currently have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Time has expired. The chair now recognizes the gentlelady from New York, Ms. Louie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Rawl. I'm impressed with your sincerity. I understand your pain and your commitment to make good and to try and resolve the situation as expeditiously as possible. I'd like to go back to the licensing procedure, which we discussed rather thoroughly with Admiral Yost this morning. And I know you will be involved with it, and perhaps 5 years was not sufficient in reevaluating drivers' competence. I'm interested in hearing from you about the structure of decision-making within Exxon itself, and perhaps this is where the problem really was, and you mentioned yourself that you can't understand how it really happened. And I wonder if we can learn from this to look at other companies, too, to see how this decision-making takes place. You have rules. You have someone who is licensed. I understand, and perhaps you can focus on this, too, that he was actually in a drunk driving course and not a rehabilitation program. Perhaps my information was incorrect. But what I really want to focus on, this is a major responsibility to drive the 60-million-gallon tanker. Who makes that decision? And is it so caught up in the bureaucracy that it really doesn't get all the way up there? How is that decision made as to who has that responsibility?
First, to the bureaucracy. We don't have very much bureaucracy, Congresswoman. But we have 100,000 employees worldwide. We operate in 80 countries. I've mentioned we have 71 ships. We produce 1.8 million barrels of oil and 5 billion cubic feet of gas a day, and we sell 4 million barrels of products, and we refine 3 million barrels of products. So obviously, I don't make every decision. But policies such as this, particularly since we're a U.S. corporation in this country, are the same in New York as they are elsewhere. Now, we have 300 people in your state, whereas in Alaska we have a number, and other states we have quite a bit more. Where that's kind of, the policy's clear, but who decides that a ship captain is qualified are people that run the marine company, which is a shipping company in Houston. Now, we have a number of other marine companies around the world, and those are where the decisions have to be made because, of, you know, that those are the people that we've given them a policy, and it's pretty clear as to how you, in a good social conscience way, try to rehabilitate people. Or the other point in that argument is if you don't tell people that if you have a drinking or a drug problem, you come in for rehabilitation, and then when we find it out, we're going to fire you, you see, and, you know, this is a pretty serious thing. So you try to use that bait to find out who has a problem. Now, what I said, and I wasn't sure you were right here at the time, that doesn't say that when you give this man rehabilitation, and it wasn't a drunk driving school, by the way. He, of course, we didn't know, we knew he had, we found out then when he told us that he had the first two, but the next one was in some other state after, more recently, we didn't know that. But what we did do was we put him into this program and paid for it through our insurance hospitalization, and then gave him what we should have done in this case, in this kind of a job. We should have given him a job back, which then would get people like this, but not this job back, or not that job running the Baton Rouge refinery down there, or driving a gasoline tanker truck in the state of Maryland. I mean, now, those kind of judgments, you can't, you talk about bureaucracy. If we had to make those kind of judgments in New York, you'd never get a decision. And we're talking about literally worldwide, we probably have 300 masters on these ships, or 250. You do have to, and if that management at that level can't make those decisions, you have to get some different people that can make those decisions.
So that your recommendations to prevent this from happening again would be as follows. What actually are you recommending in terms of decision making?
What we have done in terms of this policy now is that we still try to encourage people to come in and get rehabilitated, and this is and it's been a drug and alcohol policy for some time now. It used to be just an alcohol policy, and unfortunately, very few of us don't know somebody that has had some kind of a problem with drugs or alcohol, or certainly anybody that runs a company, you have your standard X percent of the people have these problems. Now, we have that policy, but what we are having to, what we have to do now is we have to stipulate by job title who goes back to work, but they don't do what they've been doing in this refinery or that tank truck or whatever it is, with the hope that we get the people to come in and tell us about these things. We give them a job, and then if they fail again, however, it's termination. But you got to give them some kind of a chance.
Oh, I agree with you, because there are many roles that they can still perform quite satisfactorily.
Yeah.
But I think we have to look at it very carefully as to who's making the final decision as to whether a person is competent to drive that 60-million-gallon tanker.
I couldn't agree more. And what we have done now with this list, there's not going to be a whole lot of judgment room as to, you know, they're really doing well, so maybe we can go along and go, we just can't afford to do that, and that's kind of unfortunate because it's...
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lloyd. Again, recognizing members of the subcommittee in order of seniority, gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rawl, I apologize for missing the first part of your testimony. I know that some members have raised questions of liability with you. I know Mr. Young did, and I heard Mr. Clement, and there may have been others. Let me see if I can ask you a little bit more specifically than I understood them to have raised the subject. Is Exxon willing to accept full liability for all reasonable cleanup costs and all provable economic and natural resource damages suffered as a result of this spill?
Let me see if I can ask you a little bit more specifically
Well, even, you know, all cleanup costs.
All cleanup costs and all provable economic and natural resource damages.
Well, it depends on what you mean by economic
and natural resource damages,
Congressman. I think, yes, if it's in that area. Now, when you start getting into remote damages, which I'm not a lawyer, but I understand this could roll us around the world, I don't understand it well enough to respond.
Well, I understand your reluctance to precisely respond to that. The attorneys presumably behind you would have seizures if you did. But let me try to get at this. Is it possible for you to assure us now that, notwithstanding your inability to give a precise answer, which I understand to that first question, that you will not, that is to say Exxon, will not at any point seek to prove that all or part of the damages resulting from the spill resulted from the negligence of the Coast Guard or any other agency of the U.S. government?
Is it possible for you to assure us now?
We have your unequivocal assurance.
Well, it depends on what we're talking about. My point is, we ran the ship aground. We've said we did it, and whether you get into debates as to whether the Coast Guard should have had on the radar or didn't have on the radar or what, we'll accept that responsibility, Congressman. Does that answer your question well enough?
I hope so.
Well, I hope so, too.
As you know, there is a defense to liability that theoretically could be asserted if one asserted negligence or incompetence on the part of the U.S. government or if one of its agencies.
I don't know. I don't know that you're carrying me in deep water. Obviously, you're one of the Harvard lawyers that the chairman talked about.
I don't know how to break this to you, sir, but you're 0 for 2.
I apologize.
That's okay. It was the Harvard part that hurt the most. On second thought, they're both pretty damaging.
I hope you're not going to have a claim on that statement.
No. If I could afford an attorney, I'd think about it. Obviously, I understand neither of us, I suspect, are attorneys. It's an attorney, but
I understand you know more about it than I do, though. I have that feeling.
In that case, we should. That raises another subject that I'll discuss with you in private. I just want to be sure, and I don't know that one can get that assurance in a reasonable fashion in this setting at this time, that we're not going to find a week or a month or 6 months or a year down the road when the immediate glare of headlights and cameras and the inevitable short attention span of the American people and their media has relegated this somewhere to the background. That somewhere in some court, a lawyer representing Exxon is going to suggest that the Coast Guard did not do all that they should or could have done, and that therefore at least some of the legal liability should fall on the government and the taxpayers of the United States rather than on the corporation.
Now, let me just put it this way, in operational terms, we've been in and out of there was something like 8,800 voyages with tankers in and out of that harbor. We had a large percentage of liability should fall on the government, 20% or less, I guess. We probably had bigger ships. A large number of those times, we didn't expect any radar help, and we didn't get any radar help, if that's what you're getting to right now. And therefore, when we put that ship in there the last time and unfortunately didn't get it out of there, as far as the people that were running that company, Exxon Shipping Company, they didn't expect to have to rely on the Coast Guard to get them out of that harbor. I said earlier, I think before you came in, that the weather was good and so on and so forth. So if you're talking about that particular part of it, but, you know, I feel a little uncomfortable just generalizations on this kind of thing. But I'm trying to get across my intention, our corporate intention, and the intention of the company in Houston that's dealing with these issues.
I'm partly reassured. I understand that you really couldn't go further than that without being attacked from behind there by
whichever
your attorneys are.
No, I don't even worry about that. I just don't want to walk off into a ditch and find out that I misunderstood your question or something.
I appreciate the difficulty of responding to it with precision. But let me say to you that we have an equally difficult set of decisions here, as I'm sure you will acknowledge, not the least of which is the pending request to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for exploration and possible production. I happen to chair the subcommittee of this committee with jurisdiction over that question, and I have to tell you that I have, in the absence, and this is not meant as criticism of your inability to respond with precision to the previous question, I would be astonished if you did, and I think your attorneys would be appalled. But in the absence of such unequivocal assurance, the impossibility, I should say, of attaining that kind of assurance at this point, I, for one, am even more hesitant than I was before, and that's saying something, about putting at risk these kinds of resources until we have answered some awfully important questions. Let me ask you in that regard, I assume you're familiar with the pending comprehensive oil spill liability legislation, which in one form or another has been before this committee and this Congress for most of your lifetime and mine. about...
I was familiar with some of the earlier versions.
It hasn't changed a lot over the years. It's mellowed a bit. It's been tinkered with here and there. But it's basically the same lovable oil spill legislation that we've all been through. And is it fair to ask you at this point whether or not... I guess you could speak for Exxon or perhaps even for the industry. You folks are generally supportive of that legislation now?
Congressman, I recall that several versions ago we were supportive. I guess I feel like I'd have to read it, although I trust you very much.
There's no precedent for that around here.
Okay, but we did support it. And this was a charge that was made where you had a problem, you had a fund that would clean it up. And
we will look forward to your support. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's time has expired. That was one of the best legal lines of question I've heard in a long time. We'll now recognize the gentleman from Washington State, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rawls, we've had questions on why it happened and how it happened and the cleanup and how do we prevent it from happening. I have a very parochial concern, but a very important concern to my constituents I want to raise with you, even though you've talked in general terms about it. I'm a member of the Merchant Marine Fisheries Committee. I'm not a member of this subcommittee, but I'm here because I represent a district in Washington State, and it may surprise you or not to learn that probably 50% of the fishermen that earn their livelihood fishing in the Prince Williams area, maybe more than 50%, come from Washington State. Did you know that?
No, but I'm not surprised. Yeah. I know you have a lot of fishermen.
Right. And so I listened to your concern for the residents of Alaska, and I appreciate that. But you will understand that leads me, given my concern, to the following question. How will Exxon compensate fishermen like the purse seiners and gill netters from Seattle who fish in Alaska? What about the crew members who plan to work on these boats?
Well, if these are valid claims, and for example, if your fisherman from Washington State has some diary or last year's tax return or something, or some way to demonstrate that they fished that sound, and that was their livelihood and so forth, that's a valid claim as far as I'm concerned. We'll deal with them as if they were Alaskans.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Okay, fine.
Thank you. I'm getting a lot of questions from such fishermen. Do you at this point have an address? Does Exxon have an address where fishermen in my district can write?
I'm sure we do. We have an office. I might have said this before you came in. We have a 30-person office in Valdez. I'm sure it has an address and telephones, but I'll get you an address somewhere else if that doesn't fit. I found out a lot of people know my phone number and address.
Yeah.
I'm about to change
it. I don't want all my fishermen calling you at home. It would be helpful in terms of constructively addressing this.
I think so.
If when people call me, I can say, look, here's who you contact.
We'll have it in your office tomorrow. If you're there, you'll have an address and phone number and so forth. How's that?
Appreciate it.
Okay.
One last question. Do I have a minute? Going beyond the fishermen, every year we've got thousands of people who work in the salmon and herring processing plants. We've now got a lost herring season. We may lose part of a fine salmon run. What about the people that work in these processing plants? What do you tell them?
I don't know, frankly. I'll just have to find out more about that. But as I discussed with the congressman from Massachusetts, you get into things like remote damages and other things that I really don't even understand, frankly. But if there are valid claims, and I wouldn't want to deal with all the workers in the processing plant, but presumably somebody owns it and runs it and so forth, whoever's processing plant it is, if they have valid claims, we'll deal with those people. But I you know, and don't ask me to define valid, Congressman, I'd have a lot of trouble with that. Some kind of way to make sure, we're having a lot of people show up from a lot of places that have never even seen Valdez before, frankly, but you understand.
I can appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair now recognizes from California, Mr. Bosco.
Thank you, Mr. Rawl, for your testimony. I represent about a third of the California coast, the northern part, and our people have so far been very vocally against any oil development in that region, and now they're militantly against it. And I think that watching you and the sincere professional approach you've taken has reminded me of hundreds of hearings that I've sat at where professionals from the oil industry have assured us that all of the emergency plans are in place, that all of the risks have been accounted for. People have always told us there would be risks, but that the experts are there and have the contingency plans in place. And now the term Valdez, I think, is synonymous with that ain't true. What would you say to these people on the coast who, some of them have believed this in the past?
What would I say to them if they say, what, that ain't true, or what?
Yeah, what would you say about the validity of what we've heard in this committee, what we've been told by the oil industry year after year, that these little fishing villages, these people that make their living in simple, basic, natural ways, can be protected from the onslaught of development because the experts have the plans in place, the experts have it figured out?
Well, I think we have to remind them of what they've been told. And by the way, I'm not a professional witness talking on behalf of the oil companies here. We're just trying to.
The experts have the plans in place, the experts have it figured out.
Well, I think we have to remind them of what they've been told. And by the way, I'm not a professional witness talking on behalf of the oil companies here. We're just trying to.